Margaret Drabble, The Sea Lady, 2006. Each of Margaret Drabble's 18 or 19 novels has been an accurate, honest record of its time, in the idiom of its time, and yet she has never been truly fashionable. A sharp, critical intellect keeps her keenly aware of trend, and she's never bucked it. But the qualities for which I value her fiction could not be satisfactorily called modernist, nor are they postmodern now. Of course I'm trying to avoid the word old-fashioned, because I fear Drabble herself thinks it the kiss of death. And yet what is one to say? A compelling narrative impetus, essentially straightforward, though entertainingly subtle. A moral burden, clear, though mostly unstated. Acute and amusing observation of society, gender, manners, fashions. Strongly individual characters, whose character is probably their destiny. Lord, am I talking about Jane Austen? A while back, Drabble seemed to be going a bit astray, hipped on some pseudo-issues, such as the fascination that serial murderers are supposed to have for all of us. I thought her novels suffered accordingly. It is a pleasure to read The Sea Lady and find again the canny, cagey, unfooled, intransigent author of The Needle's Eye. To get the caviling over with, I'll register my objection to one character, or voice, or persona, or whatever, in The Sea Lady, a public orator, male, who appears sporadically in a self-conscious pose to comment on the story, combining the metafictional interfering author, the Thackerayan aside to the reader, and a faint whiff of Bunyan. Some of the passages about him are eloquent. The powers of the orator are limited. They have been limited to the forethought, to the planning, to the invitation, to the setting of the stage, to the choice of the venue, to the public confrontation. After that, the actors have this terrible freedom. They can write their own script. The orator's formal script is already written, but they can write their own informal interchanges as they meet in a crowded room and as they climb the painful cobbled steps. This is risky. This is terrible. So it is. It is also revealing, but I'm not certain that the revelation is relevant. It serves to emphasize the character's artificiality while asserting their autonomy, and thus to protect the author from critical accusations of soft-heartedness. But having fearlessly subtitled her story A Late Romance, she might as well have braved it without the orator. He is, incidentally, related to, but cannot be identified with, one of the actual characters, to whom I have some objections also. This character resurfaces far too late, and unconvincingly. Occam's razor might spare him, but would shave the orator quite away. There is no need to multiply entities when you've got hold of two such good solid ones as Ailsa and Humphrey. Ailsa is the sea lady, whom we first meet dressed in silver sequined scales. She gleamed and rippled with smooth muscle, like a fish. She was boldly dressed for a woman in her 60s, and she's a bold woman, a brazen hussy of the intellect, a star in the showbiz of the mind. She is wearing her fish scales to present a literary prize, after which she will drive north to receive an honorary degree at a small university. She is the same sea lady who loved and married a man who loved fish and the sea, a marine biologist. They divorced and have not seen each other for decades, but as it happens, not by chance, he will be traveling north by train to receive an honorary degree at the same ceremony. They are converging. Ailsa is genuinely brilliant and also a fake, maybe a bit of a monster, a mermaid on dry land. Humphrey is the real thing, both feet on the ground, an excellent scientist with a strong moral sense, a kind, responsible man. She is all performer, driven by competition. He has forfeited top honors in his field by refusing to treat science as a competition for recognition. Both have had success and yet have had to settle for somewhat dubious rewards. But the two of them also have a history, and not a simple one. Long before they were married long ago, they knew each other as children in that same small northern city by the sea just after the end of the Second World War. The depth and weight of the story, its ballast, its bottom, are in the pages that relate Humphrey's two summers as a child in Ormouth and Finsterness. The flexible, steady accuracy of the narration in these chapters is marvelous. The story is utterly engrossing. Identification with the child's point of view all too often leads to the whining falsities of The Catcher in the Rye, but Drabble has always been able to write as an adult about children. Her generous and unsentimental truthfulness to the condition of childhood is very rare. Hump is a nice boy, and he has one wonderfully happy summer. Not an easy thing to write about, happiness. The betrayal, anxiety, and dubious gains of the second summer are more predictable, yet ring equally true. So satisfying are these 100 pages that the rest of the book has a problem matching them, particularly as the direction of the narrative is trickier moving back and forth. Humphrey grows up into a really nice man, again, not an easy thing to write about, but when he and Ailsa, who is not a very nice woman, but an entertaining one, first meet again as adults and fall in love, the episode fails to engage on the deep level of the Ormouth summers. It's all right, as lust goes, but novelistically it isn't much more than an interlude between the dense, brilliant reality of the beginning, children on the beach, and the guarded ambiguity of the end, with the 60-year-old smiling public man and woman receiving their accolades, and, perhaps, finally, their true rewards.